Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We're one of over two dozen around the world, on several continents, and even in some places you may never have thought of. But there's a listing on the back of our schedule here. We are independently devoted to the cause of Theosophy, which is the divine wisdom, and we often say it's ancient wisdom, but it's really timeless. It really has always existed. So it's in us, actually. It's in our nature, in the imperishable part of our being. But it's been largely ignored or suppressed for many, many years. And in the latter part of the 19th century, it became safe to promulgate these ideas once again, because there were always groups and knowers of divine wisdom. But since it ran afoul of the authorities. So in order to spread broadcast these teachings, we have two meetings a week. Sunday, you know about. Also, Wednesday evening, the doors open at 5:15, and we have a reference library available right inside the door here. And that's available from 5:15 to 7:15. If you want to study for the part, there's always a reference for the part, which is elucidating. And there is there's a library of comparative religious studies, and there's some books on math and science and things like that. But and there's always a librarian there to ask for assistance. I think our card catalog is in a shambles. I don't even know if we have it anymore. However, just ask the librarian. So here we are on Sunday. The doors. Oh, and also there's a book table that sells straight line theosophical literature and books at cost. So they're they're reasonably priced as they can be in today's world. For instance, there's an excellent pamphlet on cycles, which is $2, and it's about 48 pages of really, really good material. So all of our efforts here are voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. All may participate. There's no coercion whatsoever. So if you care to volunteer, if you care to contribute, see someone at the book table. So Wednesday evenings, we are studying. We have a study class in the Key to Theosophy. And the class, after the library closes at 7:15, the study class begins at 7:30 and ends at 8:30. And on Sundays, we have, we have talks, we have lectures, we have a panel like there is today, two short talks, and then questions and answers and discussions and comments. We're coming to the end of another cycle. So this whole month is devoted to cycles and cyclic law. So I'd like to read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So today, the first talk will be on more terrestrial and mundane matters as far as cycles in our lives go. And the second talk will be on the more spiritual aspect of cycles. Cycles are really a good bridge between metaphysics and the traditional knowledge, science, you know, those that are of a scientific bent. Often, it seems, have difficulty making that that leap into metaphysics. But a great bridge is cycles, because we can observe cycles everywhere in our lives, and in nature, of course. Right now, the trees have lost almost all their leaves. The ground is going to get cold. We've been lucky so far, but it's going to get colder, and then the ground will freeze. There'll be snow. There'll be rain. But the seeds that fall from the tree, if they have found the right soil, they are underground and they are germinating, and they thrill in a sense. Like all nature thrills. It's this cycle of, just like we have cycles of manifestation and we have cycles of after death states, all of nature is, it's seemingly asleep, but it's very much alive under the surface. So cycles, we have cycles in nature, of course. With the tree, I mean, it's very interesting. The whole life cycle is within the tree, because, and in a sense, we are like trees. They're very similar to humans in many respects, but our brain is like our root ball. It's like we're upside down trees. The first there's the seed, and then it sprouts, and then there's a twig, a branch, a leaf, a flower, and what's inside the flower? Seed, of course. And that completes the whole cycle. And as humans, we have many cycles. We have, in a sense, we have four seasons, and we also have seven-year cycles as well. There's like the age of innocence from up to age seven, when we are returning from our after-death states, and we're very innocent and very full of wonder and full of life and just, you know, don't know how to harness it all. And then the next 7 years, there's more maturity, and then we're moving into adolescent, adulthood, you know, and then midlife, and of course the winter of our lives too. But there's and the winter of our lives, if we are not, if we don't have anything physically wrong with the vehicle or the brain, that can be used as a time for reflection, and it could be a second childhood, but in a positive way, and that we look for new interest, we re-examine things that we have done, we should be doing like a life review of ourselves. So the latter part of our years, you know, if we have the luxury to have the time to reflect, we can use it wisely. Now there are cycles, of course, in nature outside the body. There's the zodiac. There's that revolution, which takes about 25,000-26,000 years for the sun to reposition itself in the same position, but a little bit higher, because a cycle is a turning. It's like a screw, and like the screw, you come back to the same point, but just a little bit higher. And it's interesting because in the first article on cycles in the pamphlet, there's a story of Mr. Judge on his way from New York to Chicago. He took the Pennsylvania Railroad, and he talks about the horseshoe curve, which you may or may not be aware of, but that was an engineering marvel of the 19th century because the way it's designed. And if you see it, you can see the train, if it's a long train, it kind of like looks like it's doubling back on itself, but it's, you know, it's higher, so it makes the grade, and then it can continue through the mountains. So it may seem simple to us, but back in the 19th century, that was a major advancement. So we have we all have cycles. We have cycles of moods, which if we keep a journal, which is always an excellent idea, we may find ourselves, you know, at some point or another, we find ourselves down. We may find ourselves having the blues or being depressed. And we should keep a record of this. So, are we going into your talk?
Don't.
Okay. Right, oh, you cleared your throat. I thought I was stepping on her talk.
No.
Okay. Okay.
So the
cycle, it's, you can raise yourself just like that spiral. We can raise ourselves up. We have the power to do that. We're divine beings, and we have great powers that we don't even know that we're in possession of. But we can do this in increments by keeping the journal. One of the best ways to get yourselves, to get, for anyone, myself included, of course, to get out of like a funky mood is to just try to help somebody or try to make a joke, just try to be pleasant. And if we keep this up, then we set up a new cycle. So if we see ourselves either moody or depressed, you know, we're not saying that we're not even going to go into modern medicine because we're not qualified to speak in that area. Of course, there are people who need medication, so we're not saying, like, stop your medication. That we would never say that here. But if you make it, the whole thing about the philosophy of theosophy is that it is very practical. And these cycles, although we're just giving a very brief, we're just touching on them here, there's much more, and we highly recommend getting the booklet if you can, because you know, we're now in a great cycle called Kali Yuga, But we don't have time to go into it. But there's cycles of man, there's cycles of the earth. So that's enough out of me.
Yeah, I'm beginning to get nervous. The point is very well made in my partner's presentation that cycles are a reality and that we as thinkers can observe them within our bodies, within the nature, throughout history, from whatever angle you come, you can observe cycles. And there is an ancient statement, a hermetic statement, as above, so below. So if we can be aware of cycles at the terrestrial incarnation level, then we are invited to consider cycles beyond the experiential evidence that we've got, and to consider cycles as a possibility using correspondence and analogy to help us out. All of the great world religions talk about a cosmogony. How did the world come to be? What happened with manifestation? And most, if not all of them, allude to darkness and then let there be light, or chaos and water, and then gradually there is the coming forth of life into a sentient condition. Theosophically speaking, that second fundamental proposition gives us a clarification of oneness in abstraction, oneness in universality that periodically emanates within everything that can come forth potentially into manifestation. At the human level, we can certainly look into this in terms of karma and reincarnation. While we can experience in a particular body, in a particular mindset, in a particular incarnation, observations of universal movement, of vibration, of universality of cause and effect, we can also hearken to the philosophy to consider something else, not as a creed, but as propositions to be used as measuring sticks for our own evolution of knowledge. If we posit that we're moving as perceivers from one source through an evolutionary periodic manifestation, then we also can posit that spirit is greater than soul, soul greater than mind, mind greater than body. But if Hermes and that teaching is correct, from the very lowest lives within our body, through the incarnate life that we are experiencing and beyond, from past incarnations, from future incarnations, we can detect natural cycles, and we can detect what it is to have the opportunity to learn by karmic action. We set out a thought, create a cause, we get a response or an effect back. We do that individually. We certainly do that collectively in families, in communities, in the workplace, in states, in nations, and across the globe. And then by analogy, if we can see cycles, as was previously stated, where there's day and night, awake consciousness and sleeping and deep sleep and dreams, then we can begin to see an analogous situation between waking consciousness, the deep sleep, spiritual existence, and a comparison to embodiment in a particular body, and then the death of that particular body, and a move into after-death states. We can also use the terrestrial observations and connect them with the spiritual observations that are possible by looking at things like a lunar cycle. And any professional who works in a high school, a mental asylum, a hospital emergency room, first responders like police and firemen will all be able to testify about the full moon and the nature of the human psyche and activity among the populations they serve, and they often are not serving voluntary populations. But the lunar cycle also can be studied in terms of the women's physicality and delivery of babies. There's so many different ways to come at the role of the cycles of nature and weather and the human being and the conditioning that's placed, the limits that are placed on expression of soul by these cycles. The philosophy would say this is not something that's arbitrary, it's not something from an external God, but rather the different states of or conditioning of experience in the East called sattva, rajas, and tamas, or the gunas, if you will, the nature of the physical and emotional or astral forms that we're using, the ping pong ball effect, or maybe the random seeming that, you know, one cause bounces off another and then interplays and the effects become very, very complex. All of that study, all of that observation points to the fact that as soul working through matter, we are dynamos. And what we choose to consider, what we choose to energize or invigorate in our emotional or personal nature, or in our mind and our soul, our heart, our spiritual nature, those impresses that we give to thought, to the reality of thought, then becomes an impress that is the basis for habit, it's the basis for future incarnations, it's the basis of reactions that we get later in this life or another life. And we can do a study of that. Historically, we're very, very fortunate. We are able to look at the philosophy and see that there's like 1,500 years of cycling among and between cultural groups that seem to have parallels. And we can look around at today's culture and national state and then look back 1,500 years in history and say, wow, you know, where are the similarities? Where are the differences? What was the problem then? What were the failures then? And how, as thinkers, can we come to our current incarnation and assist the collection of all minds in rising up and becoming more and more spiritual? We can also look at the spiritual reality. If you go back to the Renaissance, the last 25 years of every century has been an incredibly potent, magical cycle in which the spiritual impulse to seek wisdom and to seek understanding, to develop new arts and sciences and music and philosophy, or to study the classical and bring it forward, we can also trace that tremendously. If we can see all that in the finite, then we have a bit of a vision when we come to the study and the philosophy of rounds and races, or how did life come to this particular globe. We begin to understand this giant cycling, like a sine curve, if you will, a spiraling of human existence and thought and effort, and that unmitigated, absolutely unlimited potential for growth and mutual compassion and a full understanding of universal brotherhood and what it is to think critically for ourselves, to accept no blind belief or dogma, but rather to live in a reasoned, logical manner based on some eternal verities. So when cycles come around and we're comfortable with some and uncomfortable with others, we can understand that this is a passing condition and we are not that. But I'll bet you came here with a lot of ideas. Oh, there's a hand.
In the corner there.
So what is it then that actually initiates or perpetuates these cycles, this return of impressions? What is it that causes it?
There's a quote in the Epitome of Theosophy in that little pamphlet that I might as well read it because I'm not going to be able to say it very well. The universe being one thing and not diverse, and everything within it being connected with the whole and with every other thing therein, of which upon the upper plane there is perfect knowledge. No act or thought occurs without each portion of the great whole perceiving and noting it. Hence, all are inseparably bound together by the tie of brotherhood. The unmanifested, the absolute, containing within itself the potency of every form of manifestation, together with the laws governing those manifestations, there's no creation of the worlds. Rather, their appearance is due strictly to evolution. And this is the sentence that pertains to your question. When the time comes for the unmanifested to manifest as an objective universe, which it does periodically, it emanates a power or first cause, itself the rootless root of that cause. So we often say that desire first arose in it. Compassion, the law of cause and effect. Who can say, certainly doctors can't, say when the baby's really going to be born? There's no information. When that baby's ready, when nature has a collectivity of sense of cause and effect, the baby comes. The universe is the same way. It's if you think about hitting one of those vibratory mechanisms, like a metal strip, and depending on the force with which it's struck, that sound will continue to waver, the thing will continue to move until the form, all that energy is dissipated. And then when the time is right, something causes that again to come forth. So there's natural law that we may not see or understand, but that we accept that when the time is right, things begin to develop and come forth. Help me.
Okay. Well, we're not sure. Did you also want to let know, like, well, how does it know when to initiate a cycle? Was that, and that wasn't, okay. Don't ask that question.
Oh, yeah, forget you said that.
Actually, we don't think it's answerable. No. It's not, so we're safe there.
However, if we consider all of the energy that human beings put out together or in reaction to each other, we have a notion, don't we, of energy going out, creating new effects, the effects come back, we respond to that, and it's like that vibratory thing. There's a natural span of dissipation. There's natural evolution and natural energy that is transmuted from one form to another.
And there are those who are the knowers of knowledge, which we're just not privy to, because cycles, well, there's so much known about cycles, there's also equally as much that is not known about it, or more perhaps, because it's the knowledge could be misused. It could be misused and abused. So just like there's certain forces of nature, we're told not to even try to dabble in, like the alchemist of old. Some of them crossed a certain line and they ran into trouble. So, yes.
This, I don't know if this impacts directly on it, but it seems to have some dealings with the question that was asked, there's an article on the idea of the Big Bang Theory. And in the popular mind, the Big Bang Theory is some sort of explosion that moves things forward. This article counters that and says it's not a Big Bang Theory. What it really is an expansion of consciousness that it already exists. Mm-hmm. It's just that you don't have the consciousness to see it or to understand it. As your consciousness expands, then it becomes new to you, but it was already there. Perhaps that's the same thing that we see with the initiation of these cycles. It's not that it's the cycle you have to go, it's there already. You're just not ready for it. As you become ready for it, the cycle is there. You're already self-propelled.
Your comment about the cycle already is a very key one. And the Kuan Yin Pledge in its full form talks about assisting all soul to become unconditioned, that no matter where any condition or limit is, the desire, the compassionate desire, is to work to free all soul of any conditioning. And what you have to say about that intelligence is already there. Every single human infant comes back to this globe with karma and intelligence intact and in potential. And then depending on what happens karmically with the environment and with the human drive, conditions begin to change. And that child, as it develops across the seven stages of man, can express more and more of that intelligence or suppress more and more of that intelligence. But as we look at a newborn infant, that's not a blank slate. That's not an infant that has to be spoon-fed its intelligence. That soul, that potential is there. It's resident. It is.
Follow up to that?
Yes.
Go ahead.
if we use ourselves and our brothers as the example, they have already reached a higher cycle. They are already in a higher cycle. So we know that it exists. We haven't reached it. It doesn't mean that it's not there or we need to be propelled. Mm-hmm. The pathway is already there. It's just that we are not particularly ready at this time.
Right. There, there are elder brothers who have already perfected themselves as humans. The word perfectibility is not actually an absolute term. It's a relative term. They perfected themselves up to the point. There's a certain point. There's like a ring pass knot. There's a certain point where you've learned everything you need to know in this period of evolution. They have learned that in prior periods, and they're helping us. There's a guru parampara chain where one helps another through all the kingdoms of nature. But it's important to know that they are human. They just, they're working with the law. Cycles, like we have the three fundamental propositions. We have deity, we have law, and we have evolution. Well, law is cycles, karma, and reincarnation. They're all there together in law. And the law is absolute. They have aligned themselves and become one with that law. So they're not, and they won't do anything to break the law. I mean, it's foolish. They just,
they can't.
So they can influence some minor currents, they say, but they can't do it for us. They can't do our learning for us. They can't chew our food and digest our food. We need to do that. So they stand back, we think, and then they probably shake their heads a lot, but there's nothing they can do about it.
Mm-hmm. Cycles in terms of yugas and manvantaras and everything else. Well, if that's so, that implies that there's an underlying structure to the evolution of the logos, right? These manvantaric cycles and the yugas involved. So if there is this underlying structure, into which all these other laws and karma and everything else fits in. And as you said, the rootless rooting from within itself implies that the universe is evolving from within itself, within that structure that, you know, of yugas and manvantaras. So that's how I see it.
Well, mathematically or scientifically, you know, the sine curve, that appears to be the pattern for the frequency of our heartbeats, of our brain waves. It can be used historically to look at cycles of history, et cetera, et cetera. And in that number field, in that vibration, or in that duration, maybe is a good word, that kind of rhythm and vibration has a beginning and will dissipate across time in a very natural way if mind, as a beginning source of manifestation, allows it. So a lot of what we may think as mundane thought, or a passing angry response to something tiny, that, depending on the force that we bring to it and the duration we bring to it, we can prolong and extend certain periods. It's said that in the Kali Yuga, one of the four states where we are now, which is an iron age, very dark age, very fiery age, if we make effort to become the most ethical that we can within the conditions of our lives, the most philosophical and accepting of the conditions of our lives, if we make an active effort to remain rooted in universal brotherhood, regardless of what's happening in the environment, but we're rooted on the knowledge that human is a state, and as soul, we are one moving through that state. It is said in the Kali Yuga, that kind of thinking has more potency, more magic to it, more force to it, and great evolutionary steps can be made. Oh boy, lots of hands.
Go ahead.
One there and one there.
Well, either one.
Just real quickly, the prior contribution described beautifully one of the fundamentals. Everything comes from within, outward. Speaking to the fact that, as was said, all of this potential and knowledge is already within us. But to bring it out, we have to do the work. So it is correct that everything evolves from within outward.
Mm-hmm. The other hand?
We were just wondering, what connection does mankind, in his way of thinking and acting, have in connection with what's happening in nature?
mankind, in a sense, just as the elder brother are perfected humans. Now, we're not actually animals, but we have the most perfect animal body that we're using. But we are not animals. And we never were animals, and that's another interesting study entirely. But we have in nature, we have the mineral kingdom, we have the vegetable kingdom, we have the animal kingdom. Well, that is all within us. That's all. We're a part of nature. All the kingdoms are within us. And we impress those lives of all those kingdoms. And we're supposed to be impelling them in a positive way, because everything either was, is, or will be human. Every atom, this desk, everything, it's the monad. It's the two highest principles are in everything, Atma and Buddhi, which is the monad. Now, when you add Manas, the fire of mind, which is lit up in the humans, we have that trinity. that is also latent in the other kingdoms, but it is not manifest. So we are, where are we going with this? I don't know.
So we are capable, therefore, as dynamos on that oneness of plane. If the universe is one thing and not diverse, what is generated at that high level of monastic conditioning in the human plane can definitely affect the forces of nature. And, you know, without casting any aspersions, without causing any judgments, we look at a situation like the souls in Tennessee right now, where massive fires have affected so many people, and tornadoes hit at the same time, and you're looking at that whirlpool of great effect. Or if you want to look at the debatable climate change scenario, with the thinking of human beings, the use of natural resources may or may not, and again, we're not taking a political stand, but it's something to be looked at. Was the thinking of the human beings across the centuries of effort, has that produced scenarios that is now going to affect the entire climate and escalate or complicate natural tendencies in climate scenario? And again, that's for each of us to look into and to figure out where we stand. Way back there.
So, not only collectively, but individually, are we able then to change our cycles? If we've been astute enough to notice that there's cycles that come to us periodically, are we able to change those?
Well, if we're not, we're in trouble. We're like, in a sense, it would be like Calvinism. You're predetermined. And that's completely counter to the philosophy. We can always set up new cycles. We can always change. We have to work within the cycles and within the law. There are certain things we cannot change. But we can change ourselves. And in changing ourselves, we can help others to facilitate change, and we can also impact all of nature in a more positive way, a more positive vibration. There were dire warnings that were given in the 19th century when these works first became public, because materialism was getting to a point in science and religion where it was just completely overwhelming everything. In a sense, things might have, well, it's, and the warning was, you better really, that those workers that are conscious and willing to do the work, they better get to work, because the 20th century, there's trouble coming, basically. And that if we work through the 20th century, then the 21st century can be a much better place, in a sense, almost like a heaven on earth. Well, we don't know. We're not making a judgment here. We're just saying what was written. We're in the beginning, relatively early stage of the 21st century. But
well, let's look at that notion of heaven on earth. If we look within and see that there's an eternal, changeless identity or consciousness, I am, regardless of whether I was once 3 or 7 years old or, close to 70 or 100 years old, that sense of identity remains. And no matter what the external conditions of life are, no matter what the habit formation is, no matter what the health concern is, no matter what ever change of fortune comes down the path to an individual or to a collective group, that one who is able to stay focused and centered on the process of being the eternal perceiver in the moment, observing a condition, and then saying, perhaps this is a good way to act within this condition. Let me try that ethical stamp. And that kind of constant and the effort, the endeavor to maintain that kind of constant perception brings us into heaven on earth. Because regardless of what the terrestrial conditions are, the reality of the divinity and the spiritual essence and energy remains the true abode of the perception, not the external.
You mentioned the events in Tennessee. Is that a karmic cycle that's coming back as a result of the events that occurred to American Indians in the 1800s, maybe? Mm-hmm. That's to those souls who were there back then and now? In other words, how do you learn to see the cause when all we can see is the effect? I mean, how do we learn to understand the cause of the effect that we view?
Well, we incarnate in groups, and we need to... And in cycles, we need to work it out with our groups. Now, whether it has anything to do with the treatment of the American Indians, they were driven out of that area, the Trail of Tears, who knows? We can't make that. We can hypothesize, but we can't make a statement to that effect because we don't know. But we do incarnate in groups. We're drawn together. There's a lot of stuff we need to work out. We're not sure who the author is, and it doesn't really matter. But when the Europeans first came to this continent about 500 years ago, in a sense, this continent had a rest. It had repaired itself. There were ancient civilizations that were here anterior to Egypt even. And basically, this area was laid waste. Now, the American Indian worked with nature. I mean, they were really very theosophical in their outlook. Unfortunately, we all know the story, what happened. Are the two connected? We can't say. They could be. But one of the interesting statements is there's the past, the present, and the future, and they're always really together. They're really one. That's another trinity where they're one. And that we don't look at one of the authors quoted, he was a scientist, and he said that the past actually comes up from behind us. We don't really see it coming. It's there, but it comes up from behind us. So we thought that was amusing in a sense. And
it would also seem that the process of trying to understand, if we take the duration of our adult lives and we give some consideration to the today and what we're doing, and at the end of this day, to look for patterns, to look for cycles, to see where we could have improved as an ethical human being and what lessons might we still have to learn, we can also extend that a little bit. If we've got the journal that my partner referred to, we could go back and look, what were the conditions that were the same for me to reach this conclusion? What are the patterns? We may be completely dead wrong about the causation for the patterns. We may never be able to understand the plight of Tennessee right now, or anything else that occurs in current events. But the process of making a sincere attempt to say, I'm not going to accept cycles or karma just because people talk about it and they seem to agree with it, but I'm going to wrestle with this. I'm going to try to see and make sense of this and try to perceive patterns and try to see what I could do better and how I might help ameliorate a circumstance in nature. That process is what's so very important, because that occurs in the eternal now, and it takes up space and abstract motion and everything else. It's a pure effort as long as our motives are fine.
And we can take another example that's occurring, the aftermath is occurring right now. there was a horrible warehouse fire. It was being used as an art studio, and actually there were 15 or 20 people living in this abandoned warehouse that these art students had commandeered, for lack of a better word. And so what drew them all together? I mean, they were trapped in this building. They showed pictures of the building. It was obviously a fire trap. And they don't know if it was deliberate or accidental, but there's probably two or three dozen bodies that are in there that they still can't get to. Now, everybody knew that that building was unsafe, including the students themselves. Of course, kids, I guess, don't really think about these things.
Kids are kids.
Kids are kids. But the authorities had cited this building many times, but nobody ever did anything about it. So, and one of the ethical principles of the philosophy is there's the sins of omission and the sins of commission. Well, this is a horrible thing that could have been prevented, we think. But because the authorities never asserted themselves to shut it down, this transpired. So, and generally speaking, not acting, just like not acting in a deed of mercy is a terrible sin in general. But this is, we can't even imagine what the karma would be on those who did not do their duty. they were neglectful.
And we can observe that. What's the axiom? Think globally, act locally.
Mm-hmm.
We may see something somewhere in the world, or even close to home in the community, and it's enough to make you want to rip your hair out because it doesn't make much sense. Well, then the effort theosophically would be to turn that observation around, and by use of correspondence and analogies, say, what can I do to help ameliorate what I'm observing, but closer to home, within my own use of the lives of my body, the lives of my family, of my the community? What's similar to that? Why is that haunting me so much? If I see that omission of duty on a grander level, globally, how can I take that lesson and apply it locally to where I am right now? And that process is magical at many, many different levels.
And it's interesting because that's another cycle too. There's the cycle of doing your duty, and there's the cycle of shirking your duty. In the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, who is a warrior, does not want to fight. So, I mean, these are timeless lessons. But we are compelled to act eventually. But in the meantime, if we would strike while the iron is hot, as the expression goes, then we would eliminate a lot of grief, pain, suffering, sorrow, tears in this world. If we would only do that. If we see our duty and know our duty and act. See, that's the thing. If we hesitate and think, we act with the tools that we have. We act with what's available to us. We can't worry about the results if we're acting from the best that we know.
And the wisdom to be gained in the action is a strong intuitive sense of, I can empower my companion or companions to do better. I can be there when they stumble in compassion. I can help to lift them up after their errors, but I choose not to enable them and to prolong their agony.
Right.
There's where wisdom is needed, intuition is needed. Your hand's been up and down, sir.
Yes, I wanted to revisit the idea of heaven on earth, and it seems as though it might not be accurate if we listen to quite a few enlightened people who have always described this realm veil of tears that has inherent suffering and sadness in it. Basically because everything is short-lived here. Everything is constantly coming and going, which creates that anxiety and pain that we know. So I don't know if we could have an actual heaven according to what we mean by heaven, according to what, you know, when you say heaven, what you mean by it and what I'm hearing. But I don't know if we could have a heaven on earth. We might have a paradise of some sort.
When that phrase was used, I wasn't talking about a utopia or a paradise. The phrase was used this way. There's dystopia. There is agony. There's pain. There's suffering. The Buddha spoke at great lengths about what it is to be human. You know, no sense, no pain. At the human level, we've got plenty of awareness and sense, and therefore there's plenty of pain as well. We're aware of things. If we choose to identify with a dystopia and to focus and fixate on the dystopia that's around us without stepping back and meditating, turning within, and trying the process of what is there to learn here? What can I learn in order to help alleviate the dystopia for all? Then you're in a heaven state. You're in a calm, spiritual, observing, soulful, heartfelt, compassionate state. And no matter what the crap is happening, coming down, you're not identified with it. You're not reacting in it. You're not lost in the kama or the desire of it. Rather, you can pull back and sense something purer and higher. But that phrase was not meant to say that things are heavenly on this terrestrial plane. Because we're here because of unfinished business, aren't we?
As long as it's not the kind of heaven where you have to sing hymns all day. I'll be okay. I don't want that kind of heaven.
No.
But we think it was we they think the term is meant to be not literal. Just,
yeah, it's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor. Go ahead.
It was mentioned that the past, present, and future are fundamentally tied into any given moment in time. If that's the case, does that mean that every thought I have or every action that I'm about to commit are pretty much preordained ahead of time, since the future and the present are tied?
Well, you may get the thought, but what do you do with it? We always have the ability to act on it or not act on it. That power we have. That thought came from maybe three lifetimes ago. So we get it. What do you do with it?
We see that in analogy when we're parenting or nurturing youngsters who come into their degree of conscience and knowledge of right or wrong at 7, and then they start to practice using or not using that. And some of them make decisions before they're 10 years old that are going to have horrific repercussions decades later. Was the result preordained? No. Was there a decision in time and a habit formation and a state of mind engendered that without any amelioration, that effect is going to happen? For sure. But there wasn't any outside force. It was the youngster thinking according to a particular capacity at a particular crossroads that made a choice. The hope in the karmic experience is that all along the way, that youngster can become more and more and more self-aware and still capable of making changes and alterations.
We just wanted to... the pamphlet is just simply called Cycles, articles by William Q. Judge. There's 4 or 5 articles here. It really is excellent and elucidating.
It's out at the book table, and there are 2 or 3 other pamphlets.
Yeah, there's more on cycles than in this one pamphlet.
And
certainly,
you can get them for free on the internet or in the reference library at the front. This is not a moneymaker.
No, that is true. It is not. At $2, we're not making money. We're losing it anyway.
Well,
I think that's it.
That's it.
Did you want to close?
No.
Just, okay, well, thank you all for coming. And just think about, just set up a cycle of thinking about these ideas as we act. The meeting is adjourned.